This is the fourth episode now of Fork About and Find Out, and I'm joined with Tim Eisenman. First of all, am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yeah, French would be Eisenman, but that was a good attempt. Yeah.
Okay, I studied French at school, but those days are now past me. I first met Tim working at Entrepreneurs First, but we're going to go back in time to the start of university. We also both went to the same university as well, that's LSE, but didn't quite cross paths then. At LSE, you studied an undergrad in management. Do you want to talk a little bit about what led you to choose that degree?
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having me on. So I grew up in Paris and spent most of my childhood there. And I went to an international school, which meant a lot of people went abroad after passing their final exam. I think at the age of 17, I didn't really have any conviction on what I wanted to do specifically. So I just tried to optimize for maybe the best credential or like the best title I could get. So I knew LSE was a pretty good school. I applied, same kind of decision making for the degree. Actually, I knew I was interested in business, but didn't know much more than that. So I thought management would be a good course. So I applied to BSc Management at LSE and a few other UK unis, and that was right before Brexit. So I was able to come in with UK fees, which was nice as well. So that's how I got there.
Okay, so you snuck in just before the vote.
Yeah.
Coming from Paris, how did you find studying in London? Was it similar to Paris, or were there differences?
I would say, like, the great thing about London is how cosmopolitan it is. Like, going to unis like LSE here, Imperial, you meet people from all over the world. And I think that's something that I really love, and I maybe don't see as much of in Paris. So that's definitely a plus here in London. And then there's obviously differences in how the study systems work. In the UK, it's like very little hours of study, but a lot of self-study time. Whereas in France, I think it's kind of the continuation of high school, where you have days from 9:30 to 6 of classes, and then a bit of homework in the evening, but definitely a lot more lecture time.
At LSE, you're also involved in a couple of societies, one of those being Pulse Radio, which again, our paths are like weirdly intertwined without having met each other. What led you to get involved with Pulse? To give context quickly, actually, this is LSE Students Radio.
So I was arriving in the middle of COVID at LSE, so in 2020. There were not many ways to meet people. All the nightclubs were closed, all the pubs were closed. It was my residence, but I also just wanted to get involved in any society I could to meet like-minded people. And so Pulse seemed pretty cool. It was the most like kind of creative-driven and artsy-driven society, especially at LSE. And so I decided to give it a shot and applied to be a marketing manager, which I got. And so over that year, we organized a few events, obviously all online. But yeah, my time there was quite short-lived, actually.
And then the other society that you were greatly involved in was the Entrepreneurs Society as well. You said earlier that you joined LSE without really having any particular career in mind. By the time you joined the Entrepreneur Society, was that you starting to move in that direction?
Yeah, exactly. So actually, you can trace it back to a lot earlier. I come from a like family of entrepreneurs. Like my granddad was an entrepreneur. My dad is an entrepreneur. There's lots of entrepreneurs in my family. And so in hindsight, it's actually quite obvious that I wanted to do something related to entrepreneurship. And so when I went to a few of their talks, they invited Tom Blomfield, other really cool speakers. I found those like way more inspiring than any of the finance events or the consulting events. So that kind of reaffirmed my belief that I wanted to go into that direction. Yeah.
When you started attending Entrepreneur Society talks, was there a specific industry that you thought you could potentially try, or was it at this point still very just general entrepreneurship that interested you?
Yeah, I think anything related to software I was quite interested in. So during LSE, I started kind of playing around with no-code tools and developing mini apps. And so that was already kind of the path I put myself on. So software as a service, consumer software, all of that was, and still is my area of interest. Yeah.
And I think at this point, it's worth talking about Newgrain, which is my, as far as I understand, your first entrepreneurial project and in software as well. We first start with a quick summary of Newgrain and especially the origins of it. So when did you start working on it in relation to your degree at LSE?
So it was second year at LSE. Everyone was looking for an internship, a finance internship in the summer. I quickly realized I was not interested in that. I tried applying to a few internships in big tech companies like Spotify, got rejected. But really what I wanted was like building my own things. And so as I said, I started trying out no-code tools. And there was one that I really liked called Glide. So Glide is a sort of platform where you can have a Google Sheets and use that Google Sheets as the backend, like the database for your app. And then you can easily create your app based on drag-and-drop components. And so just for fun, I built like small prototypes, one of which was a directory for film photographers to discover film stocks and discover cameras that they could use to shoot film. And so I built that, I think, in like less than a week, posted it on Reddit and got like 200 users overnight. And so I thought that was like really magical. Yeah. And so I knew that there was something there. And then people wanted to contribute their own photos to the catalog as well. So then I put a feature to let them, you know, post their own photos. And just like that, it became like a photo sharing platform specifically for analog photographers. And the more I worked on it, the more I realized that there was really a need for like a dedicated space for analog photography online that wasn't Instagram or wasn't Flickr. And so over that summer, I, you know, grinded on my no-code tool, trying to develop new features however I could, and grew to 4,000 users in like 2-3 months just using no-code. So yeah, that's how it emerged. After that, I took a year off of LSE and took a gap year to focus on Newgrain. So I further developed the app, found a technical co-founder to build the app in real code, and then got into LSE's accelerator for startups. So got a bit of funding as well. So over that year, the project really like became a business, became everything I wanted it to be. And then now it's still running. We actually just crossed 10,000 users this morning at 2 a.m.
Oh, nice.
So it's really cool. And yeah, the community keeps on growing every single day. More and more photos, I think 40,000 photos at this point, posted on Newgrain. So yeah,
wow.
It's amazing to work on that still.
Were you up at 2 a.m. last night to see it hit 10,000 users?
I was just sleeping. sleep.
Okay, fair enough.
I just realized this morning.
You mentioned the LSE accelerator there. I also saw that you won the LSE Beaver Dam competition. Are those two things intertwined at all?
So that was, I think, in my, during my gap year, or my, let's say, interruption year while I was working on Newgrain. I think, in retrospect, I made a mistake because the first few months, I was just focused on building the product and I wasn't putting the word out there at all. And I wasn't taking advantage of the whole like startup ecosystem that we have in London and not meeting any founders. So I thought I should sign up and just try to pitch Newgrain and see how it gets received. So I think it was in January of that year, signed up and did my pitch and then won first prize. So that was amazing. And then after that, I did a few more pitch competitions and conferences, which I really enjoyed. Yeah.
because you did, you went on to do a pitch to like across London University demo day as well.
Yeah, that was probably the biggest one I did. So it's called London Demo Day. It happens every year, and they, so each uni picks the top 10 startups that they want to showcase. So I was selected, and I pitched in front of 400, 500 people, mostly investors. That was really great.
For a young entrepreneur preparing their first or one of their first startup pitches, what would you be your advice based off your own experiences?
I think the classic advice is the most relevant, is try to tell a story. Don't, especially if you're a first-time founder, like you're probably very attached to your product and you're probably very attached to what it can do and its features, but try to take a step back and just explain your product to someone who doesn't know your industry at all, doesn't know anything about your company. And don't try to sell too much, just explain why it's useful, why you built it, and why there's a need for that that product in the market. That's what I would say. Just focus on storytelling, engage people.
And to focus on the story that you specifically told, what was it about analog photography that led you to develop Newgrain? Was there always an interest there?
So it was a personal interest. I found my grandmother's like film camera in a drawer. I was really curious and started shooting a few rolls of film, and realized that it was a whole new way of, like, you know, doing photography, a lot more intentional. And so at the same time, I saw that on Reddit, there were a lot of new people starting to pick up film. People who, like me, didn't know the analog age at all, just grew up in the digital age, but picked up their parents' or grandparents' cameras. And so the kind of the mix of these two, like my personal interest and seeing that there was a growing like online community and market for it, it made it obvious for me to develop that.
When I watched your demo, the London Demo Day one, there was one phrase you had that stuck with me especially, which is when you mentioned that analog photos are just like vinyls. And I think that's quite a well-documented rise, the rise of vinyls. Yeah. I think you can see like similar levels of purchases of EPs and LPs from the 1980s. And I also read somewhere that cassette sales are up, like last year they were up 200%. In 2024.
Wow.
Which I think is sort of a similar thing that you see with analog photography. I was wondering whether you have any idea where this like analog shift has come from.
I think there were two big phases. The first big one is just the rise of social media, right? The rise of everything just turning online, and social media kind of promoting a lot of like engagement metrics over just quality of the content, right? Like quantity over quality. And so I think there, again, as I said, film limits you, has a lot of limitations. It limits you to 36 pictures per roll. You can only see your photos like a week after you've shot them, once you've developed them or sent them to a lab. So it really forces you to focus on every single frame. Which is the kind of antithesis of like what we have with smartphones and digital cameras, where you can just take 1,000 photos, put them on social media, or like keep them in your library and never look at them again. So that's the first phase. And I think right now, till, since not too long ago, the AI age really amplifies that, where you can now generate AI images that look extremely realistic. Most people can't tell that they're AI. And so again, there's a real need for authenticity that comes back from that, where people want to know that what they're seeing is real and that there was real human craft and intention put into it, which analog photography just forces you to do anyways. So I think that's why it's risen so much in the last like decade, and I think we'll keep growing in the next few years.
Yeah, it's really interesting that now obviously the technology is so good that even on a smartphone you can remove people that you don't like from a picture, and the technology is so powerful. Yet so many people want to keep taking analog photos. The idea of Newgrame being for quite a niche community is, I think, quite an attractive one. Do you ever envision a world where people don't really use big social media platforms anymore, and instead they have these very specific, smaller apps like Newgrame to sort of satisfy their social media needs?
I don't think so, actually. Honestly, I think the big platforms are here to stay for the time being. The advantage of Instagram is simply the network effect. Like, you go on Instagram, you know everyone's on there. So you don't need to have, if you're sending a post to someone, you know they'll have Instagram. You don't require them to download a new app just to see the post, right? I think where social platforms like and sharing platforms like Newgrame come in is as a complement to Instagram and legacy media platforms or large media platforms, where you only post on their stuff for the community, for that specific community, but you also cross post to a general audience, like on Instagram.
Let's talk a little bit about the features of Newgrame. You have a freemium model. That's definitely the marketing experience from LSC there. Is there plans to sort of introduce more ways to monetize Newgrame, potentially adverts, or is it something that you're very keen to sort of protect the authentic identity?
Exactly. Yeah. So the goal really is to avoid ads at all costs. It's kind of the value of Newgrame. And what I hear people love the most about Newgrame is that it's just ad-free and distraction-free. And so I think there's so many other models that you can look into to not go into ads. So I think the freemium model is the strongest. Over time, I plan on implementing new features to make the offer of the plus model even more appealing to people. And there might be a way for us to monetize with labs as well. So some labs would like to, get insights on who visits their page. Maybe there could be a way for people to directly order their film and film developments through Newgrame on the lab pages. And then for the labs to send the photos back to their clients on Newgrame as well. So there's lots of things to do and lots of things to explore. But for now, I think the just standard consumer freemium model works really well.
Let's now talk about two things. First would be the biggest challenges you faced when building Newgrame, and then we can talk about the biggest achievements that you've reached. So there's light at the end of the tunnel, I promised him. But yeah, let's focus on the challenges. What did you find sort of most difficult when building Newgrame?
Yeah. So definitely the technical aspect. I started building Newgrame without knowing how to code. And so I was limited by the no-code tools and no-code platforms I was using. So scaling was really, really hard. At some point, the app was so slow, like you had to wait 15 seconds for just the home screen to arrive. And so I didn't know how to code. I had to learn quite quickly. And that's definitely something I I wish I had AI assisted coding just a few years earlier, because then I would have, all of this trouble would have been avoided. But at the time, yeah, I found a technical co-founder who helped me build the app. And now, of course, I'm building it on my own. So that was the biggest challenge for sure. And your question is the biggest achievement, right? The second question.
Let's just dive a little bit deeper. Mentioned meeting your co-founder. His name's Arish, correct?
Yeah.
How did that come about?
LinkedIn. So I kind of brute-forced LinkedIn. I sent hundreds of messages to computer science students in London, hoping that one of them would, pick up on my message and have coffee with me. And so I had a coffee with Arish and we just got along instantly. I could tell he was like super skilled, super talented, and also just very fun to work with. And so it was quite obvious that he had to join me. So yeah, that's how it came about.
Power of cold messaging on LinkedIn lives on. now that you've scaled and presumably have a slightly more robust front end and back end, what does the tech stack of Newgrain look like today?
So we have two apps. The mobile app is native iOS, so it's written with Swift. And we have a web app, which is written with React and TypeScript. And for the backend, I just use Firebase. So Firebase is an all-in-one backend service with database, authentication, all of that. Pretty simple stack.
Somebody else I had on this show built a sort of interactive map where you could leave memories behind.
I saw that.
The last time I spoke to him, he had over, I think, 80,000 memories. One of the biggest challenges he faced was moderation. And he explained it as this is essentially the one part that you can't automate because it requires a human eye. I was wondering whether moderation, is that something that you've ever had to deal with Newgrain? Or is it generally been pretty easy guy?
Yeah. So we have a reporting system in the app. And so usually, quite quickly, if there's a problematic post on the platform, I get a message. So I automated that part. I just get an email. I built a little like internal tool just to see the image and then delete it if it's problematic and potentially disable the user if it's something that they've done multiple times. So it's not a big issue. The community has been relatively nice and abiding by the rules so far.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Let's move on to the achievements then. What would you say you're proudest about with Newgrain?
I think it's just the beauty and the quality of the photography on there. There's just a quality standard that's insane. Like you open Newgrain every single day and there's just stunning photos being posted all the time. I think that's the proudest thing. I think we've really created something very curated, where people post their best work and try to improve their craft as much as possible and get feedback. And the results have just been amazing. So I think that's my proudest thing, is just inspiring myself with all these photos and inspiring, you know, thousands of people as well every single day.
Studying at LSE, taking year out, building Newgrain, coming back to LSE, and then graduating was very quickly followed by working at Entrepreneurs First. Would you like to tell the listeners how that happened?
So not even followed, because I actually started working at EF while I was at LSE. Okay. There was like a 6-month overlap where I was doing a full-time student degree while having a part-time job at EF. So that was quite intense. So in my final year of LSE, I knew that I wanted to work in a team with very smart people, very ambitious people. And I was looking at Entrepreneur First. I had heard about the program through the Entrepreneur Society and other people in my accelerator. And they had a position open for data and tech. And since I had taught myself to, you know, work with data, build little apps, it seemed like that was the perfect role for me. So I interviewed and, yeah, within a week, I got an offer. So they wanted me to work right away. So that's why I had to start working part-time next to my degree, and then started full-time right after my exams.
How on earth did you manage that balance? Do you have any sort of tips or tricks for being a full-time student and a part of the adult working world at the same time?
I think what helped is that I had an end in sight. I knew that the degree was over in June, so it was like a few months of grinding, working every single day on weekends as well, managing Newgrain as well on the side. So yeah, it was pretty intense, but like knowing that it was temporary definitely helped.
And during this period, did you reach a point where you just wanted the degree to be over?
Yeah, I didn't feel like I was in the wrong place, but I definitely was looking forward to the next thing. I was looking forward to actually working, building things, joining Entrepreneur First. I was a bit impatient, for sure.
How did you find the recruitment process for EF?
again, like it all happened within a week. So it was quite incredible. I found out about the job like right before they would remove it from the online postings. I reached out to someone I knew working at EF, a couple of people actually, who referred me. I had a chat with one of the recruiters, then with the person who became my boss. And it was really nice. It was really natural. I mean, I think that's what made me decide to go there. It was all so natural. I felt like I was at the right place. It was really nice.
When I started working there, it seemed like there wasn't a single pie at EF that you didn't have a finger in. Do you want to talk about what were your sort of biggest projects while working at EF?
Yeah. So at EF, I was responsible for data and tooling, which meant organizing the database, the company's data, building internal tools for employees to log data, view data, analyze data. So a few projects I worked on. I built some apps to run the accelerator program. So we mainly used this tool called Airtable, which is a sort of integrated database and app builder. And so I was in charge, for example, of building an internal tool to track the fundraisings of companies which had just graduated from our program. And so I had to build a tool, I think, within a week or something, where investors from Entrepreneur First would report the news they heard from their company's fundraising. So obviously it was very sensitive information. All of that to kind of bubble up that information to the top and to the CEO, so she could have an oversight of how well the companies were doing in the fundraising process. So that was fun. Another one I can mention is an AI search engine that I built internally. So over time with EF, we've seen a lot of teams and a lot of founders experiment with the different startup ideas. And so we had this giant database of like startup ideas which succeeded or failed, but we never really looked back on this data and did anything interesting with it. And so I thought that there was an opportunity with AI to do some sort of semantic search. So I built this internal tool, which we called Hivemind.
So you worked on these big projects whilst at EF. Were these things that were passed down onto you, or were these projects that you took on out of your own initiative?
A little bit of both, mostly the former. So a team would come to me with requirements. I worked with the investing team, but also the fund team, the HR team, all teams at EF who needed some sort of tooling to smoothen processes. So I got approached quite a lot from different teams. We obviously had to kind of prioritize projects because we got multiple requests at once. So that was mostly how it started. But I also, you know, noticed a few patterns while I was looking at my coworkers working on their things, and saw that there were opportunities to improve these processes. So I also built some of these things on my own initiative.
I think that was one of my favorite things when I was working at Entrepreneurs First, was actually the space and autonomy you could be given to just pursue your own things. And you were talking about your almost ancestral entrepreneurial belief at a place like Entrepreneurs First, you can still exercise that a little bit. So you went not even from graduation into the adult working world. By this point, you would have been, I'm assuming, like 21, 22, 23?
When I got hired, I was, let me think, 20. Yeah, 20.
My next question is, at the age of 20, how did you find joining the adult working world, and were there any sort of teething issues, as you could call them?
I really liked it because I got to work on my biggest flaws and working on my biggest, you know, ways of working problems, let's say. So communicating with other teams, for example, is something you don't learn while at uni, right? And then you realize that half of your day is spent on Slack in the working world. And if you're not good at communicating, then that's three quarters of your time. And so learning to communicate well, succinctly, you know, lay out requirements, you know, plan meetings at the right time when they're actually needed. All of these things I actually didn't learn while at uni or working on New Grain because it was just two of us. So I think that was like my biggest working in the first, biggest learning, sorry, in the first 6 months.
One of the first things I had when I joined EF was the, did you ever do the Facet 5 personality test?
Yeah.
So about a week into the job, the whole marketing team did a Facet 5 test and we went into like one of the rooms, booked it for like 2 hours, and on each specific part of your, you know, your personality is divided into like five spectrums, and each spectrum was brought up and you could see where each person on the team landed on the spectrum. And I always remember like one of the spectrums was compassion. I don't think compassion in like a everyday sense, but like specifically as someone who works. And I remember everyone on the marketing team being having like super high compassion. And then I had like one or two. I was just like super
same,
low.
Same.
Yeah.
I had the exact same story with my team. Yeah.
Did you? But yeah. Actually, it was funny because then Sarah and HR, who was running the session, started asking me questions about the way I worked. And I almost had like a realization as we were talking of like, oh yeah, like this is actually why I get annoyed when people do this, or people find it annoying when I do this. That was like, that required a lot of humility. And I think I was 21, you were 20. I think you just, you know, you just joined the working world and you feel like you've got a reason to be there. So yeah, that was like a good humbling experience for me.
Yeah, exactly. You learned so much about yourself in those first 6 months, for sure. Like you're in the trenches, you're kind of brought to your maximum. And so obviously your deepest flaws kind of come out, and your biggest strengths as well come out as well, which is, it was exciting. Yeah.
Definitely. Looking back on your time at EF, and maybe especially those first 6 months, what do you think were the biggest challenges that you faced, and how were you able to overcome them in the end?
I think my answer to that is quite specific to my role. The biggest challenge was getting people to actually use and kind of abide by the processes that we put in place through the tooling. So obviously at like Entrepreneurs First and a lot of fast growing startups, there's a lot going on all the time. A lot of information being thrown around and not a lot of it being actually logged into structured data. And so the biggest challenge I had in the beginning, but also like throughout my time there, was just training people to correctly use the tooling. Understanding what their pain points are with the current tooling and what can be improved. And just building things that seamlessly integrate within their workflows without even them having to think about, oh, I need to log into that platform to log this data, or I need to, like open this app or whatever. And so it was really like finding this balance. And I think for, especially like the investment team, for example, who are busy all the time meeting founders, they don't have the time to really think about tooling or data. They just want to do their job well. And so supporting them in the right way was definitely a challenge.
I suppose that ties into how you communicate with other teams as well, something that you touched on a little bit earlier.
Yeah.
Okay. And then after 18 months at EF, sadly only a couple months after I joined, so I wish the overlap existed for a little bit longer, you made the decision to go do a master's at Imperial. Could you talk a little bit more about what led you to make that decision?
Yeah, sure. So I think while at EF, I realized that I really enjoyed all the technical bits of the job, but I was still just limited by the notebook platforms I was using. I was maybe coding a little bit, but I was sensing that I was limited then, and I would always be limited by not knowing really how to code and understanding computer science in general. And then I also realized that, you know, I want to eventually found a bigger tech company. And for that to happen, I need to be deeply technical and understand what's going on technically on your product, even if you're not CTO. And so that led me to apply to Imperial, this 1 year master's course, which condenses all, like everything you need in computer science in 1 year to be able to become a software engineer or build something of your own. And so, yeah, as you said, like after 18 months at EF, I think that was the right kind of progression for me. And I'm really happy about the decision so far.
I believe for the masters, you do need to do some sort of extended individual project, correct?
Yeah, right. Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Do you want to give a little bit of insight into what you're working on?
Yeah. So that's actually like quite exciting. I got the news last week that I got selected for my first choice on my project. So I'm going to be working on how to kind of encode front-end code bases to help AI testing agents to test the code. So it sounds a bit technical, but more and more of the code that's being written is written by AI, obviously. And so the problem there is that we still use the same languages and still use the same standards as humans did when they wrote the code by hand. That's also true for testing the code, for testing front-end code. So right now, if you want to test your front-end, let's say you're building a web app, and you want to make sure that this button actually goes to that page or executes that action in your logic, you kind of have to do that yourself by like running the app locally and then testing it, which now that AIs can code so fast, is actually becomes a bottleneck in your development process. So I'm going to be working on ways to actually get the AI coding agents to help the testing agents to kind of encode within and give hints within the code base that this component of the front end does that thing. And this is how it's successfully, this is how you know that it successfully works.
Interesting.
Also, something else on that, I will be working on like collaborating with CodeSpeak, which is a startup in London, kind of specializing on vibe coding, if you want to call it that, programming with plain English language. So that's going to be super exciting as well to work with them.
That sounds super cool. I studied history at university, so definitely no coding there. But in order for this project, I just built a simple website. And obviously with AI, things have become possible that were never possible in the past. But I think I've experienced exactly the same bottleneck where especially for somebody like me, where I don't really have any expertise in coding whatsoever. And if there's one tiny syntax error, like I'm not going to pick up on that. Like somebody like you who studied it properly, then that becomes like a massive bottleneck. And troubleshooting with AI is very effective, but it's also very methodical in a way that can be very time consuming well. So
exactly. Yeah. I think like right now we have agents that can write a lot of code and a lot of great code, but we still don't have enough infrastructure for everything that's around development, right? So testing is a big thing. I think most developers spend probably half of their time testing their code rather than writing it even before AI. So testing the code efficiently, deploying, making sure that the code fits the right standards and style checks, all of that still requires humans, even though we have this AI that can write the code super fast. And so I think there's lots of opportunities there to innovate.
As we move into an era of more and more code written by AI, how do you feel that coding language, or even just the act of coding, will change?
I think the change that has happened in the last year has been just mind-blowing. All of my code for New Grain now I write with Cloud Code, and it's just better than me at kind of remembering what different components, or like understanding what different components of the code base is. it's better than me at like implementing the changes. And so I think right now and in the next couple of years, it's just going to entirely shift to, you know, programming with natural language. And that means so many things for every person in the world who's had an app idea, but couldn't get going because they didn't know how to code. Now that's no longer an issue. And so that means so many things for startups. And I think there's going to be so much innovation. And also, you can see startups moving so much faster with way fewer people. So what used to take, you know, 3 weeks to develop the basic MVP or maybe 1 week now takes a day. And I think most people still don't know actually what that means for like startups. Like when you can move that fast, what should you focus on next if it's not developing, but is it like the distribution of the product? Is it validating the idea? Yeah, lots of questions. I was going to ask actually, like, how did you build your website for the podcast? Was it Cursor? What tool did you use?
To be honest, I'm essentially a blind man, so I just followed what ChatGPT said. So the front end used this this like GitHub repository that specialized in like Windows 98 style stuff.
Nice.
And that was the one thing I found myself, because I wanted to build it on GitHub because I wanted to have like a sort of open source vibe to it. And then yeah, the back end, I've got Cloudflare and Superbase basically
nice
linked up. And yeah, I don't really know what I'm doing at all, but I think what you're touching on earlier, yeah, there is like all of a sudden it doesn't really matter at all. And it's interesting because obviously you have made the decision to go back into education because you feel you need sort of higher level of expertise to then go on to these big software jobs. With the way that Claude Code and other native language tools are developing and allowing people to code about knowledge, do you think that the sort of amounts of coding and